Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, we're taking travels in Japanese time with Anna Sherman and her debut book, The Bells of Old Tokyo. Anna Sherman was born in Little Rock, Arkansas. She studied Greek and Latin at Wellesley College before moving to Tokyo in 2001. And today we're going to be talking about her first book, The Bells of Old Tokyo, Travels in Japanese Time. Anna, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's the idea behind the book, Anna?
The examined life, trying to understand the world around you, the people you meet. And although it's set in Tokyo, I think any person could do this in any place because the people we meet and the places we go, where we live, is so mysterious that it was really just my own effort to understand my own life. So,
but it is set in Tokyo.
It is set in Tokyo, yes.
And it's set around this idea of the bells. So tell us about what these bells are.
I love that you asked that question because I think that bells for a Chinese national or a Korean national or a Japanese national come freighted with this beautiful history of literature and philosophy and religion, so that certainly people of older Japanese, older Chinese, Taiwanese would associate them with mutability, impermanence, kind of a sense that the sound especially, moves between worlds. So it's very different than the Western concept of a clanging carry-on. Like, you know, we really don't have an equivalent in the West to the Japanese bell. And even it has become such a, how to describe it? Have you ever heard?
Yeah, I was going to say, so even let's go on a basic level. So this is basically a bell, not like with a big clapper inside.
Not at all.
Like a Western bell. It's a bell that you hit with a big bit of wood.
Yes, a wood that's perhaps the size of a fence slat, although they're usually cylindrical. And some of the great bells are, you know, 1,000 years old. Usually they don't last so long because they'll crack, and often, like Japan in its history, has been subject to fires. So many of them are destroyed through war or just even metal wears out. But that's the concept. And again, because in philosophy, poetry, and in some plays, bells are almost characters. They remind us of our mortality. So people don't always like that. Again, I interview some pilgrims in the book who say, oh, we don't like to think about bells because they make us think of death.
So these bells, the way the book is structured, mm-hmm. is you sort of drift through mm-hmm. Tokyo, going mm-hmm. to various mm-hmm. districts where these mm-hmm. bells are sighted or were. Some of them are not there any longer. Mm-hmm. And this is in the footsteps of another writer, isn't it? Tell me about him.
He was a very interesting person. He was a man perhaps a bit like yourself. He was used to working in the world of sound. And at the very end of his life, he decided to do what I did, which was trace these bells and see if he could find them. Although I think perhaps I'm not sure if it was because he was older. I don't know about his personal circumstances. Before I left Japan, I actually tried to contact his publisher and ask, but for one reason or another, that hasn't yet happened. So I may find out more about him, but there's a real elegiac quality to his search. So when he goes to Ueno and the bell doesn't ring, because, and now I know it's because the bell ringer's wife, I think, sometimes gets quite fed up with having to ring it every day at noon. You know, he describes just this overwhelming sense of grief that he's missed the sound of that bell. Anyway, his job was to build a universe just from a snatch of a song, or, you know, footsteps, or the sound that people make, the clapping sound before saying their prayers. Like, he really, I think, was trying to recreate this world that is forever gone. I don't know. I just found him kind of compelling. And I, even though I didn't know very much about him, but again, I feel like the book, even though it's finished, is still a thing in progress. And, you know, perhaps I'll go back to Tokyo and find out what his story was.
So, as I said, the subtitle of the book is Travels in Japanese Time.
Yes.
And these bells, one of their functions was, this is a time before, this is still a time when, you know, the Western world was basically barred out of Japan, and
we were allowed in concentrated doses. They just controlled access.
But fundamentally, there wasn't clocks.
There were clocks. There's a certain amount of confusion on this point, just because clocks arrived in the 16th century, I think in 1550 something. And they were pretty quickly adopted and adapted to the Japanese concept of time, which was much more flexible than our own. Mm. So the clocks preceded the bells. They kind of existed in tandems, but a clock was a rich person's toy. They really were more just to show you had one than to keep the hours. You know, I think that there are quite wonderful stories about the pleasure quarters, like where the courtesans lived, and they would tinker with the clock. So there are wonderful woodblock prints showing the women doing this, I guess, speeding up if they were bored with a client, or, you know, slowing down if they wanted someone to stay longer. So,
well, you mentioned there the Japanese concept of time. So okay, going back to the idea of these bells.
Yes.
Let's talk about that, the Japanese relationship with time.
Right. That's such a hard question. And it was actually the genesis of this book. And I have to be honest with you and say I never really answered it. But my solution was to ask other people whom I thought were really interesting and who would have interesting ideas about it. But the Japanese concept of time is really so layered. They inherit language from Sanskrit, which comes in with Buddhism, and that's for tiny, tiny fragments of time, and also great eternities past anything we can imagine. They inherited the concept of breaking up years into eras from the Chinese, so that there were these 60-year cycles. And then they had their own concept of time, which was really much more to do with harvests, like what the land was doing at a certain point. And it's kind of amusing that in one of the earliest instances in which, you know, the Japanese islands appear, it's in a Chinese history. And the Chinese say, these people have no calendar. They, you know, they're concept is when you plant and when you harvest, and that's it. It was something also that evolved. And I think that perhaps all the different words, and there are many, many, many different words for time in Japanese, perhaps instilled a sense of the complexity, and it's just a multivalent concept.
And so what were the bells for?
The bells were more of a psychological control that the last family of shoguns, the Tokugawa, used to keep people in line. So they told you when to go to work, when to sleep, when to eat, when to show up places. It reminded you of who you were in the world. And so even there was this one bell whose nickname was the Get Home Bell, which was rung in what's now Shinjuku. And it rang 30 minutes before the other bells so that the samurai had time to get back into, you know, basically their homes before before the curfew. So, like I said, it was more of a psychological thing.
Let's just take a step back a minute and talk about how...
Keep going back.
I mean, not as far back as that. But I want to talk about how you ended up in Japan in the first place.
Well, I wanted an adventure. I said that to the Japanese, who always looked worried. You know, I wanted an adventure. And at the time, I didn't have a mortgage or children. And so it was just... I just went. I was working as an editor in London, and I wanted to travel, so I went.
And so how did you first find it?
It was amazing because suddenly, as a 30-year-old person, I was returned to the world of childhood because I couldn't speak the language. I couldn't read. So I could neither understand nor be understood except through gesture, the looks on people's faces. And, you know, I did pick up the language and worked very hard to achieve a decent amount of proficiency, although I was, frankly, I was never fluent. But it was like a return to childhood because you were so reliant on just guessing things. And the world of the senses becomes so important. And so I think it was this profound gift to be returned to illiteracy. I mean, I don't, you know, I have known how to read for years. And suddenly to have to just fight so hard to be able to understand what was happening around you, it was a gift.
And central to this book as well, and indeed how the book is structured, is a coffee shop.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about the coffee shop and the man that ran it.
Well, I was reading, like, I had a reader recently say that I have portrayed him as if he were a sage. And I think he would think that is hilarious because he was the least pretentious person. And there was a visitor to Japan in the 60s, or perhaps he arrived in the 50s, James Kirkup, a British visitor. And he said that coffee shops in Japan were unique because they were one of the few truly democratic institutions because everyone was treated the same. And Japanese, formal Japanese, within itself has strata, you know, so that there are verb forms for speaking to animals, to young children, to equals. There's a kind of feminine Japanese, masculine Japanese. There's certainly dialects. There's the kind of Japanese that you use when you're speaking to someone who's senior to yourself, to someone who's older than yourself, all these things. And I think the amazing thing about this coffee shop was that there's a flattening out. So you come in and it was the conductor, Seiji Ozawa, was also a regular visitor. Murakami Haruki also, I'm not sure how regular he was, but he did his writing studios nearby. And those people would be treated exactly the same as a delinquent schoolgirl or a gaijin, which is the Japanese word for foreigner. And so people, I was just accepted as the person I was. And that was Daiba's philosophy, which is that if you made the coffee right and just let people be, that they would return to their inner selves, like that, which, you know, he has this idea that you spend your entire life building up armor and a front to deal with strangers. And he said, if you just leave them alone and give them the kind of coffee they want, he had other drinks in case for people who didn't drink coffee, then they will return to their true selves. And I never, until you've asked me this question, have wondered what that means to be your true self. But it was something that Daibo has a very clear sense of. And I felt able to do that there. And not like a foreigner, not like a, you know, an outsider, not like anyone but myself. And like I said, there was this flattening out in this beautiful, beautiful space.
And so, as I said, the book is structured around the coffee shop. Mm. Each chapter has a visit to it.
Mm, that's true. Well, I learned different things there. And I guess it was one of the most profound relationships that I had. There was, I was also very close to my Japanese teacher, the person who initially taught me this very strange Japanese. And so I have American friends who would say to me, your Japanese is wrong. It's too formal because no one talks like this anymore. But my Japanese teacher's mother had been a person of the Meiji era, which is roughly equivalent to the Victorian era. So I had learned this not just pre-war, but, you know, her father had been born just after the Restoration. So really, really formal, old-fashioned Japanese. And I said to him, well, when I speak this Japanese, it gets me laughs. And he said, there's the laughter of the angels and the laughter of the devil. You're getting the wrong laughs. But, you know, it was how I learned to talk. May I just add one thing? Because you asked me the question about Daibo, and I hadn't planned this, but one thing I wanted to say is that a great Japanese philosopher of time said that in the West, time is an arrow, and in Asia, it's often conceived of as a circle. And so I thought in my book, you know, Daibo is the arrow. Like, you see him, and he's young and confident, youngish, and he's got this coffee bar, which is just a, I don't know, a national treasure. And then by the end, it disappears. Spoiler alert. But and which, you know, was a grief to everyone. But it just, that's what happens in a life. You know, so it, you know, things change You know, buildings in Tokyo get knocked down all the time. And then there are the bells, you know, these circles that because they're laid out in a kind of circle. So I felt like together that was my Tokyo.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Anna Sherman, and we're talking about her book, The Bells of Old Tokyo, Travels in Japanese Time. And Anna, in the second half, I want us to go through some of the districts that you cover in the chapters.
Okay.
To begin that, though, you mentioned in the first part the Tokugawa Shogunate.
Oh, yes.
Which was the rulers of Japan before the emperor was reinstated. Mm-hmm. And before it was Tokyo. Mm-hmm. So there was a place, Tokyo was Edo before.
Mm-hmm. Edo.
Edo. Mm-hmm. Edo. Tell us what Edo was like.
Oh, well, it depends on who you were. If you were Tokugawa, I imagine it was quite a wonderful place to live. If you were an outcast, it was probably less great. If you were intellectually curious, I think it was also a difficult place. So there were certain constraints, you know, conventions. For instance, just being a doctor, let's take that as an example, or an astronomer, to get access to things that were happening outside Japan at that time. And, you know, if you're an astronomer, Newton had proposed certain laws. And you would get glimmers of this from books that were brought in from China. If you were a doctor, there were advances in medicine that were happening, you know, microscopes that were being developed, certain medicines, vaccines. And you were still having to work from texts that were perhaps 1,000 years old. And so I think that if you were an intellectually curious person, it could be very, very rigid and unforgiving because you couldn't get access to those books, you know. And so it required a lot of cunning to be able to live in the society. But you also had to consent to live within all those constraints and rules. And so, you know, often the kabuki plays are full of stories of people chafing against this regime. But at the same time, it was a peaceful, you know, the Tokugawas were masterful psychologists. So they knew how to control people. So the samurai were engaged in pastimes to distract them from doing anything that might undermine the regime. They were, anyone they didn't trust was required to be in Tokyo, or sorry, Edo, for a certain amount of time a year. And if they didn't trust you, you never got to leave. You know, you had to leave hostages. And I think that that is certainly one of the most important factors that sort of created the city, because it was all Japan. You know, and the less they trusted you, generally the further away you were, you know, like a lot of the families in Kyushu, the southern island of Kyushu, or the kind of northwestern, very rich provinces were, you know, they just had to stay. So you have a really kind of cosmopolitan culture that had not existed in that form anywhere else. So,
what was the relationship to the rest of Japan at this time then? Because it's not Kyoto. Mm. Kyoto's the, yes. Is it right to call it the capital at this time? I mean, it's the more important city, certainly.
Well, the emperor was there. Mm. But listen, I said before, this is such a complicated question that I want to back away from it just because it's just hard. And I suspect the answer is it varied from time to time, from shogun to shogun. Sometimes the shogun was rich and powerful, sometimes less so, you know, according to who was running the show. But
well, you mentioned how you would have done in Edo at the time, depending on what social strata you're in. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the outcasts, and one of the early chapters is in a district where there used to be a prison, an execution ground. Tell us about that area.
I had a reader who was saying, you need to include more about the outcasts. And they did have a lot to do with the running of the prison. Did you know that? Or no, they did. And still in these outcast districts, there are parts of Tokyo which map quite closely to, I suppose, what they were in Edo. And as I understand, let me be careful because we're on ground that I can't speak of clearly. But I do know in the prisons that they were responsible for some of the day-to-day running, because they really, this prison was run on a shoestring. It's kind of amazing and a testament to their control of the population that they were able to run it with really not very many staff.
You talk in the book about the executions of prisoners and sort of what the purpose of those were.
Yes, I really must defer to a great scholar on the subject, Daniel Botsman, who has done just fascinating accounts of life in the prisons. And as he writes it was a mirror, a kind of distorted mirror of the world outside. He describes it as being sort of bodies as signs. So you know, they were killing people not out of sadism, but as a kind of lesson to the rest of the populace, to keep people in line. It was a more of that psychological, excellent understanding of the psychology of ruling.
And then I wanted to talk about the district Akasaka.
Oh, yes.
In which you talk about, I mean, I think a side of Japan that we're sort of quite familiar with, the dark neon Japan of Tokyo, of hostess bars and love hotels. Uh-huh.
Yes, that was that's a Japanese social historian's formulation. He calls it the Sunshine City and the Shadow City. Yes, but as a rule, they kind of coexist, overlap in ways that I don't know. I think that the Japanese are kind of pragmatic about it. What's interesting is that you have maps on which sort of the Sunshine City doesn't appear. So if you have a map of love hotels, I'm not sure how this translates to apps and smartphones these days, but like love hotels would be missing on maps that had museums and cultural institutions and vice versa. Like a map of the love hotels would not include things like embassies. So almost as if they existed, the person who's written about this says it's like they exist in the people's minds, like they're kind of mental maps.
I want to bring us considerably forward from the Tokugawa shogunate to the to 1945, and the firebombing of Tokyo. You go to a museum here, and the woman who guides you around is in her 80s, and it turns out as a child basically lived through the firebombing, and she has this incredible, which again at the time she's done that, but you're not able to actually read her testament at the point, which you then, reproduce in the book, which is just incredible. So tell us about this woman, this amazing woman.
She was just so generous. And there is no sense, as she showed me around this space, which is full of relics of that terrible night, that I was an American. I mean, she just was educating me, I think. When I say that I was an American and that my compatriots had been responsible for the firebombs, the testament is very moving, and it's taken word for word from her you know, it's a translation of her words. So if it affected you, that was her writing and her account, not mine. What I found so poignant, though, is that she had been such a young girl, like only 8 years old, I think. And she felt responsible because when she, you know, they were passing people like young, like a baby. And she felt, still thinks of that baby and assumes that it didn't live and that was her responsibility. So to me, that was one of the most poignant aspects, is that what could she have done? Like, they barely had enough food for themselves, because I do cut off that account. And then she goes on, her sister was in fact injured, and they didn't have money to treat the injuries, and they go in to see a doctor, and some stranger gives money so that the sister's wounds can be treated. And but she still is thinking about this child, and there is a sense of responsibility. I witnessed the life, and the guilt of witnessing but not helping will always stay with me, as if she had been responsible. Just, yeah.
And so after the war, America occupies Japan, and obviously, you know, Tokyo needs a massive amount of rebuilding and reimagining. And, I mean, those two things are really sort of inextricably linked, aren't they? The occupation, the rebuilding of Tokyo.
How do you mean? Just because Tokyo's been rebuilt so many times.
Well, just the direction that Japan went post-war seems unimaginable.
Well, that's true.
Without the American occupation.
Yes, yes. It's still a point of contention, the peace constitution, and how it was, like John Dower is just essential reading on that for anyone who wants to understand, I think, the current political just framework of the country should read that, Embracing Defeat. I mean, it's all there.
And so, you know, bearing that in mind, what's, I mean, there's another a chapter in the book where you talk about where the Tokyo Tower now is. There's an old temple from the Tokugawa period completely destroyed during the firestorms. And I wanted to talk about Tokyo's attitude to the past. As you said, it's constantly being rebuilt. So there's, you know, the idea of preserving the past in a sort of heritage way is not necessarily something that they, you know, they share with us. But also, again, there's this idea that, you know, the city was destroyed in the Second World War and rebuilt sort of very rapidly in a sort of different plan. So let's just say something about the city's sort of attitude to its past, I guess.
Well, I think we're back to the ringing of the bell and mutability and the impermanence. It is so difficult to know, and I think that would vary from individual to individual, like how people think of it. Some of the older people whom I met, and I was fortunate enough to have friendships with people who were in their 60s and 70s, were, I think, perhaps grateful to have survived, and they didn't examine things too much. Daibo himself, like when I had come from interviewing Tsuchiya-san, who is the person who designed the memorial to the air raids, Daibo-san looked at this book that I had brought back, because it shows Tsuchiya-san's work, and he just said, why are you interested in this? And I must be clear that Daibo came from the northern Japan, and which really wasn't bombed as heavily, but I think also he was a much more optimistic generation. Like, they were, I mean, it was, he loves jazz, he loved French culture, you know, it was a kind of, he was born after the war, and was a much more optimistic type attitude. You know, there would be people my age who I think questioned, and they could look and see how much was lost and feel perhaps angry. But like I said, I think it's just, that's such a hard question, because it depends on what happened to an individual family, and it depends on, you know, person to person, like your attitude towards the Second World War, you know, versus your father's, versus, you know, someone, a millennial, you know, or a child who wouldn't have heard of it. You know, it's ancient history to them.
And just one more thing then. So now this book is written, and it's taken you, as you mentioned, a long time to write it.
Who's counting?
On reflection, what does the city mean to you now?
Wow. I loved it as the thing I could never completely understand. And I think in every person's life, there is a space like that, an idea, you know, even a relationship. But for me, it was like infinity. Just so that, I think it was Borges or maybe Lewis Carroll who said that if you had a map, if you wanted to make a map of the Earth. Like, you need a map as large as the Earth. You know, you'd have to scale it down. So I think it's a journey I'll never finish. And I was grateful to the city for having given me that.
So I've been talking to Anna Sherman. We've been talking about her first book, which is The Bells of Old Tokyo, Travels in Japanese Time, which is out now in the UK from Picador. Anna, thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.